50 years ago, two astronauts became the first humans to set foot on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We're remembering Apollo 11 here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite counted down the anxious minutes, then seconds, until the Saturn V rocket launch. In the final moments, smoke billowed from the rocket as Cronkite counted down.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy, it looks good, Wally.
What are your memories of the first moon landing? Do you remember watching on television? What are your hopes for the future of space exploration? We're at 800-642-1234. Gene Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. Gene, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, take us back to that moment. How momentous was this first moon landing?
I don't think we can compare it with anything else in human history, right? This is the first time that our species left this planet. And it took, we estimate, about 600,000 people around the world, 400,000, they say, for Apollo specifically, that many people to solve all the problems, the engineering, all the problems that were needed to be solved. Some of the math that we used was brilliant math that had never been tested before. How do you use gravity to get a spacecraft to another world? So this was stupendous. It meant that we could design computers that started, you know, in the 40s, computers were the size of large buildings, and they used the energy that was required to power a small city to something that, you know, you could use in a small spacecraft using a very small, like 70 watts of energy.
Well,
so, or the truly orders of magnitude change to make this possible.
And Gene, you know, math is your bread and butter as an astronomer. What sticks out to you when you think about the engineering that went into this moment?
I love the idea that people had specific problems and they said, okay, we need to figure out how this software, let's say, for example, is going to work with this software. How are we going to make sure the astronauts are safe? And you don't want to overdo it, right? Because if you are shouting wolf too often, then you don't allow people to do what they need to do. So how are you going to secure a balance that is as safe as possible but as productive as possible? So there are all these moments. I'm sure there were literally hundreds of thousands of times where somebody, some person unknown to us, had an aha moment and a problem was solved that made the whole endeavor exciting. I know people think about the moment, you know, that the Saturn V takes off as being the most wonderful moment, or the moment that Neil Armstrong steps on the moon. But to me, where I still get goosebumps when I see it over and over again is when you hear the goes, go, 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 when you know that each of those goes is thousands of people checking lists to make sure, yes, that works, that works, that works. So all those things had to go right for the whole mission to be successful. That, I think, is the unsung glory of the program.
We're remembering Apollo 11 with Gene Creighton as our guide. She directs the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. What are your memories of the first moon landing? Were you alive for it? And if so, where were you? Who were you with? Do you remember watching it on TV? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Judy now from Waupun. Judy, hi. What are your remembrances?
I remember the moonwalk because I was 7 years old, and we were on a family vacation, a summer vacation, and we were in a tiny little cabin that we rented in Hackensack, Minnesota. And I think we watched it on this crummy little black and white TV, and then while we went outside and it was dark out, and we were in the middle of the wilderness in Minnesota and looked up at the moon, and it was just such an amazing moment. I don't remember that many things in that great of detail as I do the moonwalk. I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
Judy, thank you so much. So Judy had the pleasure of both seeing it on television, like so many people, but also then just walking out and looking up at it and saying, there it is. There are those moonwalkers.
Right. And one of my friends, in fact, said that that's what struck her, that there are people on the moon while she was looking at the moon, and that blew her mind. I don't remember the moon landing, but I certainly know plenty of people who lived it firsthand.
Jean, the phrase moonshot is now so common, referring to anything extremely ambitious, really difficult. What were the biggest challenges that NASA was up against in making the Apollo 11 mission happen and successful?
Well, the biggest, probably the single biggest problem was to make sure that you could get the spacecraft to land on the moon and make sure that all the firings of all the rockets work just right, so that not only can you get them to the moon and have a nice soft landing, but also to come back. And a lot of those things had been tested up to a point. So I think most people don't realize that Apollo 10 basically was a dress rehearsal for Apollo 11, only the astronauts didn't land on the moon. But a lot of the procedures had been checked out before Apollo 11. One of the beautiful things that NASA does so well is it's incremental. So you try something, if that works, good. Now you add a new piece, and so on. You don't just say, okay, I'm starting afresh and, you know, hope for the best. So that is that. I think the navigation piece was probably the most challenging one, considering that our computers at that time were very modest. You would laugh with the kind of computing power, as I said, our phones could run 120 million Apollo guidance systems today.
Wow.
Yeah.
How much of the Apollo mission went as planned, and how much was improvised?
My understanding is that a lot of it went as planned. One of the things that surprised people was how many boulders there were on the surface of the moon, and they were nervous about landing on a surface that was so uneven. So they had very little fuel to spare. They just took a chance, I guess, at that point, and they traveled just a little farther to see if they could get a smoother landing, which they did. But they really had seconds of fuel to spare. So they did not have, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin really didn't have a whole lot of leeway to play with.
Hmm. You know, we'd be having a very different conversation today if this mission had failed. Are we not giving enough credit to other Apollo missions that were really some of the testing grounds that went into Apollo 11?
I think that's right. That's right. I think that we don't talk enough about this, given the triumph, I mean, truly the triumph of ingenuity and of problem solving. I was amazed with how many issues they had to solve for Apollo 8, for example. And all of these make compelling stories. I mean, really, truly, I wish that people talked more about the excitement of this kind of discovery, of how you get into space and what it takes, what kind of issues need to be addressed. So, for example, one of the things we found by stepping on the moon is that the dust, if you will, on the moon, because it hasn't gotten smoothed over time, is very, very sharp.
And let's pause right there on the dust on the moon as we remember Apollo 11 with Jean Creighton as our guide. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. Fifty years ago this week, the crew of Apollo 11 blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on their historic and record-breaking mission to the moon. We're remembering this moment here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What are your hopes for the future of space exploration? Do you want to see humans return to the moon? What about Mars? Or do you think this is a waste of money and resources? Do you think we'll ever have a moment like the moon landing ever again? Join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Jean Creighton stays with us. She directs UW Milwaukee's planetarium. Jean, as you were saying before the break there, that dust on the moon was very sharp. How was that?
Well, it hasn't been smoothed. It doesn't have, you know, wind. It doesn't have water. It doesn't have anything that will smooth the sharp edges. And that turned out to be a problem because it got into the suits. It's quite disruptive. So that would be one of the problems that we would need to solve before we go back. And there are plans to go back to the moon. But maybe that's premature to discuss the next 50 years.
Let's bring in a call now. David joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, David.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My story is I was 14 years old when the moon landing happened. I was very, very involved in watching all of it all the time. I had a scale model of the Saturn rocket. Then my uncle was an engineer for North American Rockwell. He actually worked on the second stage of the Saturn rocket.
Wow.
But my most vivid memory was Apollo 8, because we were in California visiting my sister when that happened around Christmas. And the capsule splashed down outside of California. And the next day, my uncle got us in to see the capsule the day after splashdown. I'll never forget that.
What a memory as a youngster and as a teenager as well. And that's really stuck with you. Do you think about what it would be like to go back to the moon? Where do you want NASA to take us?
Well, I'm mixed on that emotion. The moon itself as a base for further exploration of the universe is obviously going to be very important. I don't know how soon we need to do that. There's so many things on Earth that need to be helped, but all the inventions and all the things that came out of the Apollo program have obviously been extremely important. So I like to say that I would love to see continuation of the research.
David, thank you so much for that story. And Jean, what do you see as the future of space exploration?
Well, I'll agree with David. I think we're going to have to go to the moon, if nothing else, because, first of all, that's a technological that brings new solutions to problems. Also, there's no way we can go to Mars if we don't go to the moon first and use it as a base. I'm hoping that in my generation, we get to celebrate the first person walking on Mars. That would be amazing, and I think it is possible in my lifetime. So that's what I think we're aiming for at this point.
Let's bring in another call. Tom joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
The universe is so huge. Light travels at 190,000 miles a second, and then one light year, I think, is 9 trillion miles. And then you multiply that by 15 billion light years. It's just absolutely huge. It's beyond your imagination.
So, Tom, what was really special to you about Apollo 11?
Well, I saw it on this TV. It was in black and white. But my father was down there in when they had the first Sputnik up. He was a member of the Defense Committee, and they appropriated this money, so he had to go down and watch this thing. And the thing was, there were actually three of them went up. The first two exploded on the tarmac, and the public was never told about that thing. So then when I looked at this thing, I always looked at it from the point of view of being so dangerous,
yeah.
And it really was dangerous, and there's such heroic people to do it.
Tom, thank you so much. And Jean, how dangerous was this mission? What do we know?
Well, any fighter pilot will tell you that those missions are dangerous, even on a regular plane, never mind on a spacecraft that has enough fuel to blast you off the Earth. But that was understood. It was understood that some risk is involved. You try and minimize it as much as possible. Many astronauts say that they never thought about the risk. What they thought of is how to mitigate it. So what if this happens? what are they going to do to counteract it? So they prepared for it. They didn't worry about it, which makes a lot of sense to me.
What did we learn about our home planet Earth from this mission?
That is an excellent question, because that's probably, in some ways, the most important contribution of the space program, in some ways, because it gave us a new perspective, and we realized, oh, from a distance, the Earth doesn't have borders, doesn't have countries, this is a shared place, and boy, do we need to take care of our planets, because as astronauts like to say, the absolute worst place on Earth is still a whole lot better than any other place we've seen in space.
How will your planetarium be celebrating this anniversary?
We wanted to catch the summer vibe, so we've been dreaming about a party for over a year now. We're going to have music. There's going to be a bounce house face painters for the families, but also space experts will have planetarium shows, virtual reality setups, food trucks and ice cream, also ice cream for people who want to pack a lunch. This is, after all, a free event and open for everyone. We do hope to have a large crowd. There's going to be indoor air-conditioned space as well as outdoor with lawn games and everything else. So it's going to be a fun time, and I do hope that our community can come together and celebrate our achievement of Apollo 11.
Jean, we've been talking this week just about how there's been so much focus on this anniversary, and media outlets have really been embracing this history. What do you make of that?
I'm happy. Anytime that people think about the larger picture, anytime people think about how to explore space, I think that's wonderful. And maybe we don't do enough of it, you know, in our usual daily existence. So I'm very glad that we're talking about it now.
What are some of the technological innovations that we have today because of this first moon mission?
You mentioned before, what do we know about the Earth? And that is one of the things that has helped Apollo helped us. Because now we can send satellites into space, and we can look at our Earth and see not only how things are changing, say, about climate, but also things like campfire. That huge fire in California was discovered from space first. So they were able to get on it and try and battle that terrible fire. And these are the sorts of things, you know, from mundane things, but lots of people depend on, say, what are appropriate practices for agriculture. You can anticipate when you're going to have a drought and so on. So these are things that people don't realize that are part of the fact that you can know the weather is part of the Apollo program, that we have satellites that tell us about weather patterns around the world. The fact that we have cell phones that you can pick up and call anybody on the Earth has to do with having satellites, communication satellites around our planet.
What do you see by way of cooperation among scientists around the world when it comes to space? Because, you know, we were in a cold war when we were watching Apollo 11. And since then, there's been a lot of political upheaval among countries. But what is it like among the scientists?
The scientists have always been more likely to get along because we're motivated by the same things. We want to solve problems. I'm happy to say that that sense of coldness, from the 60s is now changed, and there's much more collaboration, partly from necessity, because people realize that individual countries have a hard time paying for these programs, so it's much easier if people collaborate to do something together.
Do you think we can recapture a bit of that national unity from 50 years ago and make that national unity come around space in the future?
I sure hope so. I sure hope that people feel proud, if not for directly contributing to the program, or at least for funding it. People support the space program by spending a small portion of their taxes to make that possible, so everyone should feel proud.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Happy anniversary. Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Coming up, President Trump is trying to distance himself from the racist chant at his rally earlier this week, saying he wasn't happy with that message. We'll talk with a political scientist about the attacks against minority women congressmen and hear your thoughts on it. It's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're headed to Capitol Hill now to talk about President Trump's rhetoric and his attacks on four minority House lawmakers. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of the lawmakers the president railed against Wednesday night at a rally in North Carolina. She said yesterday she has concerns over her safety and is discussing with Democrats whether to ask for additional security.
There is no bottom to the barrel of vitriol that will be used and weaponized to stifle those who want to advance rights for all people in the United States.
So what do you make of the president's messages that these lawmakers should return to the places from which they came? Regardless of your political leaning, do you think the president's comments are out of line? What should the standard be for a president? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University, where she teaches courses on African-American politics, political participation, and race in elections. She wrote the book called Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So let's start with this resolution the House on Tuesday approved to condemn President Trump's recent comments directed at four Democratic lawmakers. Just so we're all on the same page, can you remind us where this started, where this firestorm started in the first place?
Well, last Sunday, President Trump issued a couple of tweets that suggested that some members of Congress should go back to the countries where they came from so that they could improve the conditions there. And it was widely interpreted and it was affirmed in subsequent statements that he was referring to four progressive members of Congress who had been feuding with Nancy Pelosi the week before. And so they call themselves the Squad, and so they're progressive. They all happen to be women of color. So it's Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, and Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts.
And so this drew swift reaction from Democratic lawmakers and led to this condemnation resolution that was passed this week. What does this resolution do?
So it's a non-binding resolution. I think it was just it's symbolic and it should be acknowledged as such. But what it did was to express Congress's disapproval of the statements that President Trump had made. And I think they were doing it largely because you have a member of one branch of government kind of publicly impugning the characters and saying really racist and vile things about, you know, members of their own body. And so I think probably in the minds of the Democratic leadership and those who sponsored this bill, this was a way for them to kind of publicly stand up in defense of fellow members of Congress and their right to serve. They're American citizens, and they're duly elected. And I think it should be noted of the four members of the Squad, Ilhan Omar is a naturalized U.S. citizen. The other three were born in the United States. So the idea of telling people to go back where they came from. One is an offensive trope that's often used against immigrants. It is used against African Americans as well. You know, when people are told to, you know, go back to Africa or go back to Mexico, even, you know, when they're born in the United States. But, like, in particular, sort of this idea that members of Congress should go back to someplace else as though they shouldn't be serving just because they disagree with the president politically and have been vocal about that. That was what I think they were trying to counteract.
And then take us to Wednesday night at a rally in Greenville, North Carolina, where we heard the chants. Then that echoed what the president had tweeted.
Yeah, so, you know, during the speech, he talks about, you know, his objections to Congresswoman Omar, and Congresswoman Omar has made some really controversial comments, some anti-Semitic comments. And so, you know, as he was going through the things that she had said, then people in the crowd started to chant, "Send her back." That was actually met with condemnation yesterday, including from Republicans. And so President Trump has tried to back away from the comments, saying that he didn't endorse the comments that or the chants that were coming from the crowd, and that they made him uncomfortable. But I think that, you know, there has to be this larger conversation about moral leadership. Would the crowd have felt that comfortable saying that if he hadn't already kind of started the process by suggesting on Sunday that she go back to her own country?
We're getting analysis from Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie. We're looking at President Trump's attacks this week toward four minority House members. Do you think the president needs to tone down the rhetoric, or is that what you perhaps like about him? Is that all of this just a distraction from other issues? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Danica calling from Madison. Hi, Danica, what are your thoughts? Oh, and Danica, are you there? No, we can't hear Danica. Andra, there were some conflicts among Democrats about what kind of measure they'd see passed against the president, and some calling for this censure resolution. What would have that done?
So a censure is a stronger condemnation of the president. And, you know, one of the things that would have happened with a censure is it would have put President Trump in a class with Andrew Jackson. So a president hasn't been censured since Andrew Jackson. And so it would have just been a stronger rebuke of the president. You know, it still, I would argue, would fall into the class of being more symbolic. Like, you know, it doesn't impeach the president. It wouldn't remove him from office, but it would be a more, you know, it carries greater weight. And so it would be a stronger condemnation of him.
Well, let's look at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has been really caught in the middle a bit as she tries to maintain some control over the Democratic agenda. She said yesterday, you have to give the president credit for being a distractor. And here she is on the House floor.
Every single member of this institution, Democratic and Republican, should join us in condemning the president's racist tweets. To do anything less would be a shocking rejection of our values and a shameful abdication of our oath of office to protect the American people.
What is she getting at here, Andra?
Well, I think this is, I think she is articulating why the Democrats in the House in particular felt a need to issue some type of formal condemnation of his speech. President Trump was, you know, attacking freshman members of Congress. He was attacking women of color, which is something that he's done in the past. If we see his interactions with journalists, female journalists of color, are actually particularly particularly pointed. And he's also attacking members of Congress, like basically saying that they don't have the right to serve in the offices for which they are constitutionally eligible to do and for which they've been duly elected from their districts. And so I think this idea of attacking, you know, members of Congress was something that I think Speaker Pelosi thought members of Congress as a body could gather around, that you kind of close ranks to protect your own. We saw the Democrats do it. We saw four Republicans from vulnerable districts join with them. And we saw Justin Amash, who, you know, is a former Republican, now turned independent congressman, who's been a critic of President Trump, join in that condemnation. That, like, there comes a point at which one has to say, hey, like this person is a member of my body, they're my colleague, so you put your collegiality kind of ahead of whether or not you have policy disagreements with them or even strategic differences with them.
How difficult is this for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to negotiate as she tries to focus on an agenda, on agenda items? How does she get the work done?
Well, I mean, you know, it's always going to be difficult to get the work done. And in terms of the end product of, you know, legislation that could actually reach the president's desk for signature, she was already structurally disadvantaged with that because there are many bills that are going to get through the House of Representatives that, you know, are dead on arrival in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. And so Mitch McConnell has seen to it that, you know, there are lots of issues that won't see the light of day in the Senate. And so, you know, the things that will get passed are the things that have to get passed. So things related to the budget, for instance, there are certain things where you do see bipartisan support. So, you know, we have seen certain types of bills actually be able to make it through the entire legislative process. I think the thing that Pelosi is thinking about is how to make sure that Democrats who are, you know, itching to start impeachment proceedings against the president do so in a way that's responsible, in a way that's actually evidence-driven as opposed to not being emotionally driven. And when President Trump has outbursts like this, it becomes even harder to control. So we saw that after the resolution condemning the president's remarks was passed, that, you know, almost immediately Representative Al Green of Texas, you know, is starting a bill to try to introduce articles of impeachment. And it was interesting. You know, our Constitution is very vague about, you know, what you can do to remove office. It just lists the process, and it says that you can do it for high crimes and misdemeanors. But it's left up to Congress to decide what a high crime and misdemeanor is. What Green tried to say last week was that racism was a high crime and misdemeanor. And through this debate, there's actually been a debate about whether or not the attacks or the tweets were racist. I certainly think that they are and would argue why I believe that this is the case, but there are members of Congress who publicly disagree with that.
Well, yeah,
and it's not obstruction, right? Obstruction seems to have more teeth to it. So the idea that you were introducing articles of impeachment for that, strategically, I would argue, was probably not well thought through. But there are a lot of people who feel that way, and, you know, we're gunning for the president as a result of it.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has accused Democrats of just playing politics here. Is that what is going on?
You know what? I mean, I think the Democrats were reacting to a tweet from the president. And while there's always politics and people are always sort of angling for the right strategy, I think it's also really important to point out the ways that President Trump was playing strategy. So after the tweets, earlier this week, we saw members of the squad have their own press conference where they stood up for themselves and condemned the president's remarks. And President Trump is tweeting during the press conference about how now he's backed the Democrats into a corner. Because these women are perceived to be very progressive and, you know, in the minds of some to be extremist in their views, he was arguing that basically by forcing the Democrats to let go of their squabble from the week before about whether or not Pelosi was singling out the squad for being women of color, now he's like, now I've got them all identified with you. And so he's trying to paint AOC, you know, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Pressley as the new face of the Democratic Party.
And let's pause right there with Andra Gillespie of Emory University. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about President Trump's attacks against four Democratic minority congresswomen. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And at that rally in North Carolina this week, the crowd broke into a chant of "Send her back" against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She was greeted yesterday in Minnesota with other kinds of chants, warm chants. And this is the latest fanning of flames by the president after he tweeted Sunday that the four lawmakers should, quote, go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. All four are American citizens. Do you think the president needs to tone down this rhetoric? What do you make of this? We're at 800-642-1234. And Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie stays with us. Let's take a call now. Let's go to Derek joining us from Galesville. Hi, Derek.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
So I just had a comment about him saying go back to their old countries. I mean, if he really cared about America, they should stay here and help us with our problems, you know? And I don't know why he would say that, because they're American citizens, you know?
Where do you think this will take us?
Well, he's taken us to a bad place already, I think. You know, he said make America great again, but it's not happening.
Derek, thanks for the call, Derek. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie with that. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I kind of disagree. I think that what Trump said is a reaction to the identity politics that the left is playing, and I wish at the end of the day Pelosi would get these four women to stop using the identity politics. And I think if they stopped doing it, I think Trump would stop using it as well. And I do wish Republicans would call him out to stop, reacting to their identity politics junk that's out there to try to win votes.
Steve, thanks. Andra, where do you see this identity politics playing a role?
So identity politics is everywhere, and it's not just the province of peoples of color. It is... It's ironic that the caller just brought that up. President Obama got elected using a strategy of deracialization and an attempt to try to de-emphasize racial difference and promote transcendence so that he could build a multiracial coalition to get elected. And yet President Trump questioned his nativity and questioned whether or not he was a U.S. citizen in a trope that was arguably racist. One of the things I would recommend is I'd recommend a great new book by my colleague Ashley Jardina at Duke University. It's called White Identity Politics. And so she's explaining the ways that white identity, is important, how it can predict vote choice. And it basically really affirms the idea that, race is part of America's original sin is not just sort of politics that people of color play, but that it's also sort of politics that whites play. So it's a really important book. I highly recommend it.
Let's bring in another call now. Anne joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Well, I think this man is totally out of line. He's crossed the line way too many times, and I really think it's time for him to be impeached. This is not behavior becoming of a president of the United States.
Andra, you were talking earlier about Democratic U.S. Representative Al Green introducing articles of impeachment, this being the third time he's done so. There are now more Democrats in the House on board with this?
Well, if I recall, this resolution got 90 votes, more or less. So this is still definitely not a consensus. The majority of Democrats are opposed to this. What I was saying before the break was, I view what Green did as a largely symbolic act. I get that he was frustrated. On the other hand, strategically, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. He was trying to argue that the president should be impeached for racism at a time where, one, people are arguing whether or not that's racist, and then there's the larger question of whether or not that is what we consider a high crime or misdemeanor. And so what I would say is that
Yes, how lucky are we that we are the home of Harley Davidson. Our museum is a perfect tribute to all that that company has given our state. It's 130,000 square feet, so you can spend a good amount of time there. It tells the stories of the people and the products, the culture and the history of Harley Davidson. You can see the bikes, the whole history of the bikes. You can peek into the archives. Some of that has never been opened before to the public, and that is now. Or you could take a guided tour. It's behind the scenes, kind of look at things. You can grab a bite to eat at Motor. Just stroll the museum's Riverwalk or check out the Living Legend walls and plazas.
What about if you really love boats? And we're having some technical issues here at Wisconsin Public Radio as we've been talking about President Trump's tweets this week, getting your thoughts as well with Andra Gillespie, who is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. Having time here for just a few more thoughts on what is going on, and we had left off here before the power surge on impeachment. Andra, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so sorry about that. We're having some power surge issues this morning. But just some final thoughts here. Are we going to hear louder calls for impeachment as we inch toward next year's election? Or will House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tamp that down?
Well, I think a couple things have to happen. First, one, we need to see what happens during Bob Mueller's testimony next week. One of the things that will get interesting is that impeachment is going to be a really dicey proposition as we get closer to the election. So actually, as we move into 2020, we might actually see calls for that go down. I think probably the big question is how tolerant are Republicans going to be about President Trump's antics? If they become more vocal and start condemning the president's behavior more, then maybe we'll either see greater calls for impeachment or we'll see President Trump tone down his behavior. And so I think it's really incumbent on Republicans to not be afraid of primary challenges and to speak out and call President Trump out for his behavior. So whether or not you agree or disagree with it, there's a certain level of decorum that we're not seeing that I think would actually be really, really needed in our politics right now. And he would be the one to kind of take the lead on that. And he's not doing that.
And when you say it gets dicey as we edge toward the 2020 election, why is that so?
Well, I mean, so part of the issue then becomes, you know, if you're going to remove the president from office, like, you know, what does that look like, you know, if he's, you know, secured the nomination, the Republican nomination for president? You know, right now he doesn't have particularly strong challengers on the Republican side. Does Mike Pence step in? What would people feel about that? And then also there's just the political element of this looks like a political ploy. And so do you then give President Trump additional ammunition to use against whoever the Democratic nominee is? So I think, you know, there are a lot of kind of logistical and actually strategic arguments that would suggest that trying to impeach a president in an election year might not be the best thing to do, especially if you think that you have a chance to remove that president from office via the electoral process.
Andra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University, and she is also the author of the book Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.